No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008 or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. That's BBS Radio 1. Last week, we introduced you to our new co-host, Maria. So now that we've gotten to know her a little bit, we're going to talk about issues tonight. And we'll start to continue to have guests next week, again, with Dr. Miller, to discuss education in America. So please call in tonight and be part of the conversation. Again, the number is 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us. Before I go any further, let me introduce my co-host, Maria, who joins us from California, the land of sun and fun and really cool people. Maria, are you out there?
I'm here, Michael, on the left coast.
All right. Yeah, on the cool coast. You know, we all want to be the cool people like the people that live in California. Every time I've been out there, I've just been impressed by what just a great state it is and how nice the people are. So,
well, it's diverse, that's for sure. And then you can generalize, unfortunately, about some of the Southern Californians in particular because of the vanity and the plastic surgery and the conspicuous consumption that drives a lot of our economy. But there's good folks, too.
Well, you could say the same thing about Washington, D.C., especially the conspicuous consumption part. Just looking at Congress, you could they probably consume way more than their fair share. But before we get started tonight, there's a lot of cool things to talk about. But I just want to go over quickly what's been happening in the fight for D.C. statehood, because there's some interesting things going on. First of all, although we had no co-sponsors for the statehood bill this week, there's been a lot of exciting developments. First of all, D.C. Council member Vincent Orange has introduced a resolution in the council to which I testified on Monday in favor of an effort to get 1 million signatures nationwide in support of D.C. statehood. Wow. And he would like to present these signatures to the Republican National Convention, the Democratic National Convention, and the White House, and every member of Congress. So that's kind of an interesting idea, because if we were to give them physical copies with 12 signatures a page, each document would be 84,000 pages long and take up 10 cartons of paper. So, I mean, it would be very dramatic to do that. It's a big goal. The Republican convention starts in approximately 8 months, so that would mean we'd have to gather 30,000 signatures a week between now and then to actually meet the deadline. So, well, I don't know that we can do that, but we're going to try, and it would be interesting. And in addition to that, even more significant, this would be a great development if this would happen. My colleague, Senator Strauss, is flying to Brussels later this week to deliver an application to make Washington, D.C. part of UNPO, UNPO, Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization of the UN. So what this would do, this would make us the first group in North America to be part of an organization that has 44 members around the world, mostly in Africa and Asia, who are not represented, ethnic groups that are not represented in their own governments. And the fact that the UN is even listening to our argument is a first big step. And if it happens, it would be great, because it would make us part of a body that's international and fights for the same cause that we fight for, basically. So it would give us a lot of exposure and a lot of or some additional clout. I don't know how much clout, but additional clout. So we're excited about that. And we wish Senator Strauss all the luck in the world. And when he comes back from Brussels, we'll probably have him on the show so we can talk about it. So those are all exciting things that are going on.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brown, in the interest of folks that might be newer to the program of Shadow Politics, is your cause bipartisan?
Well, we try to make it bipartisan, but it's not really bipartisan. It really, Republicans pretty much stand against us.
Why?
And let me say, as a lifelong Democrat, they stand against us because we're the most democratic, and by democratic, I mean Democratic Party, jurisdiction in America. We have no elected Republicans in the District of Columbia. We've never had a mayor that was a Republican. We've never voted for a Republican for president, even though we've only been able to vote for president since the 1960s. We've always voted for Democrats. Even when I worked for Jimmy Carter, and Jimmy Carter won Georgia, which was his home state, Minnesota, which was his vice president's home state, and Washington, D.C. So we're always very, very strongly Democratic Party, and the Republicans stand against us because they don't want two Democratic senators with a vote in the United States Senate. And I just want to say, as far as full disclosure goes, that really annoys me. But if everybody in Washington were a Republican, I'm pretty sure the Democrats would do exactly the same thing. It's really become a fight between, you know, do we have two new Democratic senators or not? So that's one of the things that would make this thing with the UN a big deal, because we'd get it out there and people would have to stand up and go on record on where they stand, where right now, you know, this is kind of a sideshow here in Washington. Since we're the only people affected by it, a lot of people don't really understand the situation or care about it one way or the other. So.
And how long have you been fighting the fight?
Well, I've only been fighting it for 8 years, but the people of Washington, D.C. have been fighting it for 210 years, actually longer than that, 214 years now, since our rights were taken away in 1801 by an act of Congress. And a lot of people think that the Constitution says that we don't have the right to vote in the District of Columbia, but it doesn't. What it says is that Congress shall have exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the District of Columbia. So it means basically Congress can do whatever it wants to do with the district. So Congress really took away our voting rights.
So this event in Brussels with the UNPO, is that correct, the acronym?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is it like a court that you testify in front of and then they decide for or against your cause, or how does it work that they sanction you and approve you?
That's exactly how it works. I mean, you go in and you present an application, which I understand is 50 pages long now. They review the application and they decide whether you meet the criteria. And for the most part, we do meet the criteria. There are a few very technical arguments going on, legal arguments about being a country, being part of a country that's already represented at the UN, because these people are indigenous people that are not, mostly indigenous people that are not represented in the mm-hmm. UN. That's their argument. Now, can we justifiably make an argument that as American citizens living in the District of Columbia, our interests aren't represented at the United Nations? And we say, yes, we can, because we're not represented in our national legislature, and those people put together the policies that are then represented at the United Nations. But we have to, I think we have to see whether this group in Brussels agrees with us or not.
But they've agreed to hear what you have to say. They've put you on their agenda.
They put us on our agenda. They've allowed us to put in an application, and they wrote to my colleague and invited him to come and speak before the panel. And Paul Strauss, who's the other senator, is a lawyer, so he's well suited to do this. And they've invited him to come over. So our feeling is they probably wouldn't invite us to come over and pay our own way and, you know, go through the expense and the effort it's taken for a 50-page application if there wasn't at least reasonable interest. You know, I think that we feel like we have a reasonable shot at getting this done, although it's certainly not a done deal. And we do have certain countries or certain other groups that support us. For example, the Nagas in Nagaland. And Nagaland is a little area that most people don't know about between India, Pakistan, and Brunei, I think is the other, or maybe it's Burma. I'm sorry, Burma. And this is an indigenous group that's very compact, and they support us. Populations that you might be more familiar with are Tibet is also a member. Taiwan is also a member. The Hmongs of Vietnam, or are they Vietnamese? I believe they're Vietnamese. They're also represented. They're an ethnic group that's not represented. So we have a few countries that support us, and the Taiwanese support us, and the Tibetans support us, and those are both big groups. There's 44 members of this organization, but those are the two of the more recognizable names. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of countries or a lot of groups on this list that I've never even heard of. So
when they hear your case, do they have to make a decision, or can they, what do you call that? Do you take it off the agenda to decide at another point?
Table like, it?
Yes.
Yeah,
table
I don't know. That's a great question, Maria. I don't know if they're obliged to make a decision or whether they can put it off. But the hope is that they will make a decision. And I think we all feel good about it. Whether they decide in our favor or not, the fact that they're standing up and listening to this and considering it as a viable, maybe a viable application, mm-hmm. I think is a good thing. Washington, D.C., many people may not know this, but we were the first human rights city in the United States, which means that we've agreed to do certain things to accept certain principles of human rights in Washington as we conduct our government business. There are others. There's several in California now, I think. I know for a fact San Francisco is one. Mm-hmm. Los Angeles may be one too. There are many, but Washington, D.C. was the first one. And we find it really ironic because some of the things that we've agreed to adhere to, we're not entitled to in the district. So we find that, kind of hypocritical. And we've dealt with the United Nations for years. We've been bringing our cause to the United Nations. So the fact that they're now paying attention to us in itself is a victory.
Well, it sounds obviously like you're sitting at the correct table and having the right conversation with the right guests. And that's why I asked if they will make a decision or not, because maybe this is an opportunity to put the foot in the door and to have a creative discussion about what it is that you're looking for, and they may need to table it to get more information from independent sources so they can make a better informed decision.
Well, and they might do that. And even if they do, the fact that they would go through that process of trying to investigate it would be a positive thing for us. Because one of our big things is we've done these nationwide studies, you know, where we've seen that 80% of Americans believe that we should have the same rights everybody else does. And it's really not much difference between Republicans and Democrats. It's like Democrats are like 81% and Republicans are like 79%, something like that. I mean, there's a very slight difference between the two sides. But unfortunately, 80% of America doesn't know that we don't have the same rights that they do. Because why would you, you know, you would naturally think that the nation's capital has no voting members in Congress. Everybody's got voting members in Congress, right? So the capital of the United States is just kind of counterintuitive that we don't. So a big part of our problem is just getting the message out to America and to the world that we don't. You know, Jack Kemp, who you know, yes, was a Republican congressman and a cabinet member, was somebody that was on, he wasn't on our side for vote for statehood necessarily, but he was on our side for voting rights. And he used to say the one reason that, that got him involved in the fight was when he went to China and they started to talk about human rights, the Chinese delegate said to him, "Do not lecture us on human rights when you do not allow the people in your capital city to participate in your own government."
Really?
And yes. And Kemp said, "I thought about that statement and I said, yeah, he's right. Who are we to lecture them?" You know, of course, when you're being scolded by the Chinese on their human rights record, I mean, that's really saying something, isn't it?
It is. And so my question to you is, especially now with the predominance that was all things Democrat, why hasn't this become a top agenda item for the rest of the country?
Well, that's probably one of the best questions, is if the Republicans in Congress care enough not to make this happen, why don't the Democrats care more about making it happen?
Exactly.
And we're not sure about that. Now, we have 145 co-sponsors on our statehood legislation, 143 in the Senate and the House, and they're all Democrats. So they support us, but it's tacit support. It's lukewarm support. There's nobody out there giving speeches. You know, and we've tried to energize them for a long time. We recently, last year, had a big, you know, we had a big thing happen in that the president of the United States was asked if he believed in D.C. statehood by a high school student in the District of Columbia. And he said, "Yes, I do believe in statehood. My kids live in the District of Columbia. I live in the District of Columbia. And I believe that the people of the District of Columbia should be equal." So he said, "Yes, I'm for it." And the president said that Bill Clinton actually went up on Capitol Hill and testified for giving additional voting rights for the people of the District of Columbia. He testified in for legislation that supported the idea. So we have support, but everybody's got bigger priorities. And I think the thing is that it doesn't affect people in Nevada and New Jersey and Wisconsin. It only affects us. Mm-hmm. So it's like world peace. If I said to you or anybody else, "Do you believe in world peace? Is that something you would support?" I think 99% of people would say, "Yes, we do." Right. We support the idea of world peace. But what are we doing for it? You know, are we doing anything proactively to establish world peace? No. I'm really not, because I'm worried about getting my kids to school and I'm worried about feeding my family and paying my mortgage and, you know, doing the things that we all need to do to survive every day in this world. So I think that's our problem.
Well, I think that what you just shared is great news and congratulations. And thanks. That's a huge and significant movement in what it is that you're looking to achieve.
And, you know, I agree. And since we've, since I've invoked the name of the Chinese, what do you think about them against
nice
the policy of one one child, you know. Now, I know you have four children.
And, I did.
And I have three children. And when they became teenagers, I started to think maybe the Chinese didn't have such a bad idea, you know. But
I had four teenagers for 3 years in my household. So I know of which you speak. But for 35 years, they've had the one child policy, and for them to go back on it, I think it was more a reality that they are not procreating new generations because there are an inordinate amount of men and not enough women to go around. And so it's a practical thing probably more than it is anything else.
Right. Well, you know,
apparently the wealthier men are taking out billboards, or their parents are, and saying, "This is my son. He is eligible." I don't know if you would call it a dowry, but you know, you will do well if you would consider marrying him, et cetera, et cetera. But there are more that can't do that kind of thing than those who can. And so there's a whole generation of men that is not going to be partnered or coupled.
Yeah. And well, and you know what? It's often been a practical matter, hasn't it? I mean, we used to, when we studied history in the United States, they used to talk about how farm families would have large families because they needed them to work the farm, the family farm, and because infant mortality was so high, you know, they would have almost like spare children, as strange as that sounds. But yeah, that's the tragedy in China, isn't it? We all saw the Joy Luck Club, and you know, the tragedy is they've not only you know, had this policy, but they, how many millions of baby girls have they let die over the years?
Or selectively abort.
Or selectively abort. Yeah. I mean that's really been the challenge. And
well, and not to single out China, because I had the privilege and the honor to go to India to volunteer with Rotary to participate in the National Immunization Days to eradicate polio. At the time, India was one of the four that still had polio. Now it's been declared polio free. But they said that the families would have lots of children so that at the age of five, they could send them out to work so that they could bring money to help support the families.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that sad? And by the way, just while we're on that note, God bless you for doing that work. My mother had polio, and I think I was the first one in line for the oral vaccine when it came out in the United States. Yeah, my mother was a lucky one who only had she was left after the braces and all the other nonsense that they used to go through. She was left with a limp. A little bit of a limp, but other than that, she was fine from the disease.
Now, there's a post-polio syndrome that has been affecting survivors of polio. Did she suffer from that?
No, not that we know of. You know,
nice.
My mom died years ago, so you know, she died almost 40 years ago. So it was, she died of breast cancer, but yeah, the polio had little effect. And let me tell you, my grandmother took her to a chiropractor every week while she had polio, and she used to swear that this is what saved her. And whenever we had an ailment as a kid, I'd probably been to a chiropractor a dozen times before I reached the age of 12. You know, whenever we had any kind of ailment, the first stop was the chiropractors. I don't know how good they are, but
well, how progressive is that?
She swore by them.
I mean, that's as the backstory, because some folks probably are listeners that are too young to know that polio was a scourge. In 1985, when Rotary approached Jonas Salk, who had created the polio vaccine, there were 350,000 cases a year in the country, and now we're down to less than 1,000. I'm sorry, in the world. So it'll be the second disease to have been eradicated behind smallpox in our history of the planet. So it was ambitious then, and it's becoming a reality now. And the way that we've been able to do it, we're the boots on the ground, and I say we as in Rotary, but the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has stepped up big time, as has the World Health Organization and UNICEF to some degree. So I was able to dispense the vaccine because now you don't have to give the shot anymore. It can just be the drops.
Right.
So in other words, non-medical personnel is able to do it too.
Right. I remember the little sugar cubes in the cup or whatever it was.
I'm old enough to remember that.
And you know what? Groups like, I don't think a lot of people know this, but everybody should know this, that Americans are the single most charitable people on the face of the planet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not necessarily our government. There are other governments that give more in foreign aid as a percentage of their gross domestic product or the gross national product than the United States. But there's no country in the world that gives nearly what the United States gives through private donations and groups like Rotary and Doctors Without Borders. And, you know the whole list of people that volunteer in America. We give tons of money and tons of volunteers. Tier service, so we should all be very proud of that.
That's one of the things about philanthropy that's so inspiring, is that you're not just helping yourself and your community or your children and your family, you're helping the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Depending on whatever your cause is. And the Doctors Without Borders, I think they've had two hospitals now that have been bombed.
Yeah, what is that?
I don't want to weigh in yet, because I don't think all the information is in. But they said that we were involved in the first bombing last month, that they thought that terrorists were operating out of it. Nevertheless, I don't know who signed off on it. But then another one was bombed this week.
Yeah, I know. And it's terrible, and there's always collateral damage. And those of us that were old enough to remember things like My Lai, the massacre during the Vietnam War, understand that, you know, sometimes there's culpability and sometimes it's an accident, but we really need to look into that. And you're right, all the information is in now, and of course the military is saying it was a tragic accident, and maybe it was, but these guys really go in where they're, you know, to the front lines where they're really needed. And I guess that's always, you know, something that can happen. But that's
what you would think, because I've been a volunteer with the American Red Cross as well. And when somebody has the Red Cross on their back, they're supposed to be sacrosanct and safe. And when they've been gunned down too, you know that the respect that was once afforded some of these institutions is no longer there anymore.
Well, it's a different world, isn't it? During the Second World War, I think that the thing you say about the Red Cross was pretty much the case. I think they were pretty much respected around the world, and I think that even though there were different levels of compliance between groups like the Japanese and the Germans and the Americans, mm-hmm. I think that most people obeyed by the Geneva Convention and treated prisoners in such a particular way. And, you know, and do we still have that anymore? I don't know. Is this the world of terror warfare has changed things? I don't think Al-Qaeda or ISIS conforms to anything. And that brings up a whole new discussion. How do you fight these people?
Well, and not to compare, but a prisoner was finally released from Guantanamo this week after being held and not charged for 14 years.
14 years.
And he was released to the UK, where he's a resident and has a wife who's from there. And, I'm not quite sure how that passes or flies. How is that possible? But it is.
Yeah, it is, because they're not afforded any of the protections that you would be afforded as a citizen. They couldn't legally do that to you, but as a enemy combatant, I guess that person doesn't have any rights. And yet it's a terrible situation. The whole Guantanamo thing, I think, is a tough one. I think it should be closed, but I understand people who are afraid, who say, look, these guys don't play by any rules. Why do we need to play by any rules? I understand that, but I think that we need to take the higher road. I think we do need to play by rules.
Which we usually do. And as they say, that you know, about a person, you can tell about their character, about how they treat their mother or their children or their pets. And then as a country, how we treat our disadvantaged speaks to how we are as a person, as a character. So I would suggest the same is true with those folks who are incarcerated. Although a backstory, Michael, is my folks have caregivers because they're both addled. And one of the gals that was their caregiver, she was a guard at Guantanamo when she was in the armed forces. And what she had to endure by what the prisoners did to her is unspeakable.
Well, yeah, especially as a woman, right?
Yes, and a blonde woman.
These guys don't have the, you know, I mean, I think one of the most amazing stories I ever read was in the Washington Post, where they talked about navigators, I forget what they call, pilots on the Chesapeake Bay. Now, you cannot bring a 700-foot ship up through the Chesapeake Bay into Baltimore without a pilot. It's required.
Is it like a tugboat or something?
Yeah, you can't. It's a navigator, and you're not allowed to navigate yourself. You have to pick up a pilot at the foot of the bay somewhere, and that person navigates the boat to Baltimore. Well, this causes a little problem for all the oil tankers because they're Middle Eastern for the most part, and the pilots' union is got both women and men navigating because most things.
Really?
So what happens when a woman is, you know, there's some system by which you're assigned, okay? And it's probably, you know, you're probably on a list somewhere, right? And Maria's the next person up, so Maria right. gets on the boat. And right. that's part of the union negotiated contract. So when there's a woman involved, what these guys have to do is they have to hire two pilots, and the woman then gives the male pilot the instructions, and the male pilot then converts that.
Oh dear Lord!
Really? That to the captain of the ship. Yeah, can you believe
Whoa.
That? So they use two pilots, and the two American pilots work together to get the information to the ship's captain. So yeah, it's
and we've spoke last week about women and being underserved and underrepresented and, you know, not in the boardrooms and not in the halls of DC and stuff like that. So you're bringing that home, which also then brings one of the stories that we talked about full circle about the third woman last month to complete the Army's Ranger School at Fort Benning, Georgia. So they Yay. Opened it for the first time in April of this year. 19 women started. 3 were in the finals. 2 graduated in August. And then this woman, she's a major. She's 37 years old. She's a wife. She's a mother. She's an engineer for Shell Oil Company. And she's one of the highest ranking and oldest, regardless of gender, graduates of the Ranger School.
Well, you know, I mean, that doesn't surprise me in the least. Anybody that knows women knows how strong they are, you know, and I think that we've always thought about how emotionally strong women are because they carry the burden of our families, right? They carry our children to the caregivers, the people that we rely on for so many important things. But physically, they're strong, too, you know, that they're God makes them stronger because they go through childbirth. They resist disease better. That's why there's more women in the world. If you don't include the Chinese and their strange policies, why there's more women in the world than men? Because they have a lower infant mortality rate.
Right.
So that doesn't surprise me at all. And it's about time. You know, my brother, this is how far women have come. My brother, he's a few years older than I am, was an instructor and a counselor at the United States Air Force Academy. And he was there when the first class of women was allowed in. Mm. So it wasn't that long ago, you know, 30 years ago maybe, that they first allowed women into the military academies at all. Mm-hmm. So this is, I think it's great news for women.
Well, what's funny is that there was a man, his name's Andrew Exum, and he's a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, and he was a Ranger. And he went on Twitter and he said, I can't believe a 37-year-old graduate from Ranger School. I'm 37. I was 22 when I went. 37 is old.
So, you know what? They need to meet Mrs. Brown. I can't tell you how old Mrs. Brown is because I've signed a confidentiality agreement, and if I violate it, she'll sue me. But she goes to spin 4 nights a week, and I'm sure that she could carry me, the children, and the 120-pound Labrador Retriever out of a burning building any day of the week. So,
but you remember when the police and the fire didn't have women, and then when they begrudgingly admitted them, the men were like, I don't want a woman behind me who can't carry the hose that I need to be, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the Ranger School emphasized that there was no special treatment or lowered standards, that, you know, what a woman has to do to graduate from the Ranger School is what a man has to do. So we've come a long way, baby, in some regards and not far enough in others.
Absolutely. And you know what? My brother said to me that when he went to the Air Force Academy, they all went through sensitivity training about the women that were coming in. He said, but it wasn't actually the instructors or the military personnel that gave these people the hardest time. It was the other cadets who were somehow offended that women were there, you know, because they'd always seen this as a boys' club. Mm-hmm. So I think that's interesting that we have come institutionally, we've come very far, but as a society, yeah, we still have a long way to go, which again, you keep on throwing me these softballs, is a great segue into a study that you came up with, and you're going to have to speak to this because I don't know what's going on here, but a 3-year study that was done that showed men are not interested in intelligent women. What's that about?
Yep. They say intellectually they like the idea of dating intelligent women, but when they're actually confronted with the reality of it, they pulled away. And so as you mentioned, it was a 3-year study. The reason that it got on my radar is one of the authors of the study is a professor at a university here in my area. And so it involved the University of Buffalo in New York and California Lutheran University, which is in my neighborhood, and a third institution. And it's been published this month in the Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin. And the conclusion is that men find the prospect of dating intelligent women intimidating. And they what they did is they divided them up and they had control groups like they always do with psychological studies. But the bottom line was the men took this 15-question math quiz and were randomly told that they passed 8 of the questions, but that the woman who was down the hallway had actually passed 12 of them. And so, which wasn't true, the women were conspirators with the scenario, but all the women were attractive. The other university is the University of Texas, Austin. And so when they had the opportunity to meet them, they said, sure. And then when the woman actually came into the room, they said not only did the spark extinguish, but the body language, they pulled their chairs further away so that they wouldn't have as much personal space contact with them, which they said that showed that the men got cold feet. So the conclusion said in this, one of the articles said, who knew masculinity could be so fragile? And I think, of course, the male ego is fragile.
Oh, my God. It may be one of the most fragile things out there in society is the male ego. And I think one of the reasons for that is we're always stroking it and telling men how great they are. And, you know, I mean, especially in this day and age where all my kids, your kids probably fit in this category too, played soccer and they always got a trophy. They got a trophy for coming in last place. You know, they got the last place trophy. I remember one of my kids getting a ribbon for coming in 13 in a swim meet. And I looked at my wife and said, 13th? And she said, yeah, the 14th.
God bless you.
Thank you. The 14th person only made it halfway across the pool. So, you know, but yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And just let me give you a little advice, men out there, if they're young men out there listening to us.
Or men my age, because I'm still in the dating pool.
Yeah, okay. Well, I've been married for 24 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. To the valedictorian of her high school, my wife went to a large New Jersey high school, and she graduated number one in her class, went on to college, did really well, went on to graduate school, and graduated with a 4.0 average, even though she had three kids. And I can tell you, you want a smart woman in your life. It makes all the difference. Look, my wife tells me what to do anyway. So it's better to have a woman that knows what she's talking about telling me what to do than anybody else. But that's my kind of backhanded way to say happy anniversary, honey. I hope you're listening. But I've always been attracted to intelligent women, and I just find it so unusual that people are intimidated by that. I've always thought that it was not only I think it's attractive in a woman. I mean, that it's sexy and that it's, you know, I don't understand why men are so easily intimidated.
Well, I think it has, like you're pointing out here, Michael, it has less to do with the woman than it does the man. If you are confident and have a healthy ego, not a super ego, but a healthy one, that would be a better partnership than to have somebody that you have to drag along for the ride, or you know, pull along, or show the ropes, or explain the world, or what have you, when you don't have a true partner.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think there's also and right now, Maria, my wife is laughing if she's listening when you say if you don't have a super ego, because you know she refers to me as the ego that ate Texas, but I think that's absolutely true, and I think that. You know, it's about giving that perception that we're the big boss, and we could get into a longer discussion about America in general, about, you know, where it's more important to drive the big car and the big, you know, as soon as you can afford the house you live in, you start looking at bigger houses. You know, it's that perception I think that men have that I'm in charge here and I don't want to be told what to do. And yeah, and I think you're right. They're just intimidated. It's as easy as that.
Also found that about, I don't know if, I really haven't found that about women, but men who tend to either be really attractive or very much in shape because they're a gym rat, they have such an ego because they love themselves so much that they want to spend all of that time on themselves. And don't get me wrong, I work out every day. 7 days a week, cardio. And so I'm fit and in shape. I don't have an issue with that, but I'm talking about the preening and the over musculature and the what have you, where, you know, I think life is to be lived. And so, you know, we all need a glass of wine or a martini or a bite of chocolate every now and then, if not regularly. So,
well, you know what? I hope you're listening, honey, because Maria just laid it out for you. The fact that I never go to the gym just shows how confident and that I eat a lot of chocolate and a lot of pizza. I'm enjoying life, and I got every mile on me to show for it.
My only issue with weight is not because of what it looks like, but because of what it can do. And I'm talking about overweight, especially tummy fat, because that is unhealthy for all of us.
Well,
and I'm not talking a little tummy. I'm talking about the big tummy, the beer belly, if you will.
Well, you know, I think that we're all as a society, as, you know, I'm a diabetic, as diabetes and these other diseases go up, I think we're becoming more and more aware of that. But women at the gym, I know a lot of my wife goes, and she's like you, Maria. She has a sister who's in perfect shape, who you know, exercises every day, and it's all about being healthy. She's a nurse, and Pat's the same way. And you know, I've known several women in my life who are very dedicated, much more than any of the men I know. But I wonder how much of that isn't because of gender stereotypes too, that we look at, you know, because we don't care how women think, we care how they look. You know, I wonder how much of that drives women more than men.
Well, you know what drives me, honestly, is the serotonin and the endorphins that it elicits. I do it because it makes me feel good. And then the byproduct is that, oh yeah, boosts my metabolism. It helps create more muscle. And my puppy likes it when I take her out as often as I do. But I do it because it really, it's like a drug.
You know, that was the way it was for me too. And then some terrible person introduced me to vodka. So now I get my serotonin in other ways.
I'm a vodka drinker too.
No, I'm teasing. We all need to do more of it, and women are just much more body conscious. They really are, and you know, and it's a good thing. It's a healthy thing because you know what? If you want to be a size 4 or size 6. I don't care if it's out of vanity or why you do it. You're going to be healthier in the long run. We know that now. We
yes.
know that you know that you're going to not only probably live longer, but you're going to enjoy that more. Not only because of the serotonin, but because you'll be able to get up and down stairs.
Exactly.
You know, I'm starting to get to the age where things are becoming more of a challenge for me, and I'm realizing, yeah, it's time to get some of this weight off because it's debilitating in more than just the long-term effect, but even in my everyday life. So,
which leads us to another one of our topics about the World Health Organization coming out this week that's saying no to hot dogs and processed meat and ham and bacon, raising the risk of colon cancer and prostate cancer and stomach cancer and probably other organs. They studied over 800 studies to get to come to these conclusions. So, and the studies were scientific. So it's not just a random, you know, how they, every time they reintroduce the food pyramid or they say you can have milk or you can't have coffee or, you know, whatever. This was more than a meta study, if you will. So, I hope that you're going to take that under advisement if any of those are on your to-do list in terms of what you like to eat.
Well, you know what? I don't know what the hell I'm going to do at baseball games if I can't have a hot dog. I know
Obviously, moderation is the key to everything. And if how many baseball games can you attend and how many hot dogs are you going to be consuming in a year? I'm sure it's not weekly.
I can eat a lot of hot dogs. I don't go to a lot of games, but you know, I'm not a big hot dog eater. But I am, you know, I do love my bacon from time to time and, you know, and other things that aren't good for me. I eat a lot of things, you know, and that may be something that people don't understand about growing up poor. I grew up poor and the two cheapest things you can get are fat and sugar. And so my diet was just riddled as I reached adulthood with sugar and fat. We didn't really care about, you know, my grandmother used to take a dollar's worth of bread dough, which when I was a kid was a couple of pounds. You know, you could make 3 or 4 loaves of bread. And she would stretch it out and deep fry it, and then we would cover it with sugar. And that was breakfast, you know, because it was cheap. You could feed 4 kids on $1.50. So, you know, I think it's not just about getting food to people that need it. It's getting education to them too.
Here's one of the, I think more managed messages from this. One of the scientists said that they're not trying to terrorize people into thinking they should not eat any red meat at all. But they are saying that those processed ones are not as good, which makes sense, right? Because they've been addled or they've had additives.
Right. Tons of sodium nitrate and other things.
Right. And those preservatives and stuff. And so they say that there's sufficient evidence that it could cause cancer, but things like alcohol, asbestos, and tobacco are 20 times more likely. So you kind of do have to put it into perspective, and I think you did that for us by sharing that it's not an all or none thing. It's just like if you're going to make some choices, maybe you might want to make better choices for your health and longevity is all.
And I got to tell you, with every health choice that I've made, I'm happy for everyone. You know, like I really don't drink. I'm the absolute social drinker. I have I had a gin and tonic on Friday night, and I probably haven't had a drink prior to that in 2 months. You know, I drink maybe a dozen drinks through the course of a year. I used to smoke a pack and a half of Camel cigarettes a day, unfiltered Camel cigarettes, and quit 17 years ago. And,
wow.
And I'm glad that I did that, you know, and they've all improved my health. So everything you can do, I think really helps you, every little thing. You know, Marie and I have had fun talking about all these subjects today. We also had on our list that we were going to talk about several other political issues. Maybe we'll put them off to next week. But I would like to talk about the debates a little bit. I'd love to get your input on the debates. How do you think the debates went, the Republican debate last week?
Well, I have to be completely honest here because I always am. I was in class, so I was unable to see the debates firsthand. So I only know from what I've read and what I've been told. And again, that's somebody else's opinion,
right,
spooning feeding me, if you will, even if it's an AP story. So all I know is that I heard CNBC ask some questions that would seem to be pretty personal and inappropriate, and that the RNC has sent NBC a note that they may or may not participate with them on the debate that's scheduled for February 1st. So maybe you could be more informative.
Well, I think that, yeah, that's all right information. And I got the impression, and I might be wrong, that they're really telling NBC they don't want them to be a part of the debates in February. And I don't know how I feel about it. I watched the whole thing, and I was disappointed in some of the questions that were asked. I think they make a rightful distinction when they say that they start out by asking Donald Trump, is your campaign a comic book? You know, is this a comedy? I think that really does fall into the kind of classic gotcha question. We always say in politics, you know, there's those questions, have you stopped beating your wife yet?
Right.
You know, there's no way to answer that question, right? It's just not a yes or no answer that you can get away with. And so I think there is a point to that. I also agree with my friend Dan Rather that there was no particular bias in this. I mean, I think the Republicans are saying there was bias, and I think it was more sloppy journalism than it was, you know, trying to get these guys. I mean, I didn't get that sense from it, but I was disappointed in it. And I wonder if the bigger question isn't, is this what politics has become in America?
That is the bigger question.
Do we really want People Magazine? We don't want U.S. News and World Report.
Right.
We don't want, you know, we don't want the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or whatever the legitimate publication is. We're more interested in Donald's hair than in his positions. I think it's sad if that's true. And since we're talking about men and women, who didn't complain? Fiorina. I didn't hear her anything that she said that was, you know, anti-debate. The rest of them, Bush, our governor, Christie,
right.
Yeah, and so Rubio and several other people complained about them and complained, rightfully so, complained on the air. I think that's the place to do it. It's not to wait till the after. And I think that, you know, Christie got a lot of applause when he said to the commentator, do you want to answer this question or you want me to answer it? You know, because that was part of the thing. These guys were interrupting and they were, you know. But, I think it's going to be an interesting race. And I hope this is a wake-up call for journalists that, yes, I mean, it was Christie made a good point when he said, why are we talking about these things when we should be talking about the issues?
Right.
That's what America cares about, right? You don't care.
Well, and you know what, Michael, though, I've saw it firsthand in terms of journalists and their pugnaciousness, if you will, because I was interviewing Mike Huckabee at the Reagan Library several years ago, and there was another journalist in the room, and he kept interrupting, stepping, like verbally pushing, jarring, jabbing, elbowing me out of the room. And it was like, that's what creates then this kind of hostility, if you will, because you have to fight for yourself to be heard. And it's not my nature to do so at all.
Wow, and you're, and it seems like your dog is also agreeing with you. Look, we only have a few minutes left, but we have Taboo on line one, who's a regular caller. Let's see if we
can find out
what Taboo wants. That's all right. Taboo, are you there?
Okay, Taboo, note to self, dog goes in another room.
Taboo, are you there? Yeah,
I'm here.
Yes,
on.
I am. Hi.
What's up?
A couple of questions. I know nothing is 100%, but I was just wondering about the discussion that you were having about the male females, you know, and the test that they were taking.
Uh-huh.
And the ego of males. I was just
yes.
wondering, do you all think there might be some ethnic differences? Do you think American blacks generally view females as you were describing?
Do I think in general that the study was biased?
Do you think the same goes aboard for, let's say, white Americans and black Americans? Do you think they have that same ego?
Well, I think it's more important what you think, Taboo, as an African American. I really can't speak to that. I don't know about Maria, but for me, I come from a matriarchal family. My grandmother ruled everything. But I don't know, and I've always considered black families to be matriarchal. What's your feeling?
Well, I don't, you know, as I said, you know, nothing's 100%. But, you know, in general, I would say I'm sure it's there. But I would think, you know, for our ethnic group, I don't think it would necessarily, I would say the majority would not be the case. You know, if you go back, a lot of times girls or the females went to school and males had to work in the field. So it's nothing for our females to have more formal education, you know. And I think, you know, I would say it might differ a little bit. I don't know. I was just wondering what you thought.
You know what I'm going to do is drill down into who these 600 undergraduate 19-year-old men were. Because that's a great question. Now, because they were college educated, and I believe they were all students at the University of Buffalo, maybe that lends itself to a certain ethnic mix also.
Yeah, and probably that age population probably wouldn't be much of a difference now anyway. So that could be a factor as well.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have
And the other question
is,
I know
I'm sorry, Taboo, we're out of time. We've run out of time.
I love the fact that you called. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, and thank you, and welcome.
And call in next time with your question, and we'll answer it, okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. Have a good week.
All right, Maria, it's up to you. We're signing off. Say goodbye.
Thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed our program.
Me too. And we'll see you next week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.